Tehran carries out three executions during the past week on varying charges as rights groups condemn the practice.
This execution caused shock among human rights activists because there were no prior reports on their situation.
Plus, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi recently visited Syria. Does the trip impact the relationship between those two countries?
I don't think it does necessarily anything to fundamentally transform the nature of the relationship.
And later in the program, has the practice of jailing dissidents lost their power to instill fear? From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Iran's judiciary announced the executions on Monday of two men who were sentenced to death for blasphemy. The judiciary's Mizan news site identified them as Yusuf Mehrad and Sadrullah Fazeli Zare. The report said their crimes included insulting Islam and the Prophet Muhammad. They also said that they used online platforms to spread hatred of Islam and promote atheism. This comes after the Islamic Republic said Saturday that it executed a Swedish-Iranian dissident, Habib Farajola Chaab, was convicted on the charge of, quote, being corrupt on earth, end quote, for his activities with the Struggle Movement for the Liberation of Awaz, which is an Arab separatist group in Iran. State television says the group launched an attack on a military parade back in 2018 that killed 25 people. Now, joining us to further understand what happened is Siamak Degampour with VOA's Persian service.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me. Yusuf Mehrad and Sadrullah Fazeli Zare were hanged. Mehrad's family had no idea the execution would occur, and they were told Yusuf would receive the Supreme Leader's pardon. So the execution happened in almost complete silence. This execution caused shock among human rights activists because there were no prior reports on their situation, as I mentioned, and that's why there was no public campaign also or any efforts to stop it like other cases that we have seen before.
Really quickly, I wanted to ask you about the public reaction to this, because as you mentioned, this was carried out without a lot of foreknowledge. And later on in today's program, we're going to hear about some analysts and their thoughts on whether or not the continued jailing and imprisonment of dissidents is losing its effect. So how have those in Iran and really the Iranian diaspora reacted to this?
Yes, you know, Iranian diaspora, since especially the last 6 or 7 months or 8 months after the Woman Life Freedom Movement in Iran, has been very vocal and active inside and outside of the country. And they've been very upset about the rate of execution as it happens recently. According to human rights organization, there has been a 75% increase in executions in Iran since the movement. And this year so far, more than 200 people have been executed. As you know, in two-thirds of the world, capital punishment has been banned, but these executions are based on the Islamic criminal codes in the Islamic Republic's judiciary law. So people still calling for the regime change because of all of this. They believe that these laws are enshrined in the Constitution of Islamic Republic, and there has to be major changes in order to see things change. So, and as I have to also mention that the EU issued a statement and called this situation and very concerning. They've said the restriction imposed on consular access to EU nationals, the denial of consular protection and the right to a fair trial stand in direct violation of international law.
Speaking of EU access to those who are imprisoned, over the weekend, Habib Farajola Shaab was also executed. And he's a Swedish-Iranian person who's been held in captivity for some time based on allegations that he was involved in an attack in 2018. What more can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, you're right. He was accused of being behind the deadly 2018 attack on a military parade where soldiers and civilians were killed. Habib Chab, or Cab, was a founder of a separatist group calling for independence for ethnic Arabs in Iran's southern western Khuzestan province. And I'm sure you know the oil-rich Khuzestan province has a sizable Iranian Arab minority, which has long complained of discrimination. So Chab was reportedly lured to Istanbul, Turkey, to meet a woman before being kidnapped and smuggled into Iran. And he was sentenced to death for corruption on earth. This death penalty is the second execution of dual national in 2023. I'm sure we had a conversation in one of the other programs about Ali Reza Akbari, Iranian-British, who was executed in January. So some analysts believe the regime is testing red lines. As you know, Jamshid Sharmat and Ahmad Reza Jalali have been given death penalty verdicts as well. And this operation is kind of similar to what happened to Ruhollah Zam, who was kidnapped from Iraq and executed later in Iran. So this is becoming a new norm for Tehran. And as you know, there are increasing number of EU and dual national detained in Iran. And this is becoming a major issue between EU and Iran.
One last question in the time that we have left. I understand also the Persian service at VOA is also reporting on what appears to be some potential changes to curriculum at universities in Iran. What can you tell us and share with us about what is known?
Yeah, the Supreme Leader has been calling for some of these changes, especially in social sciences. And they think that students in university have been projected by it been receiving educational system that's not in line with what the government and Islamic Sharia should promote. So that's they're trying to make some of these curriculum according to what they perceive.
Siamak Degampour is with VOA's Persian service. Siamak, again, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi wrapped up a two-day trip to Syria last week. It was the first visit by a president of the Islamic Republic in 13 years, with agreements to boost economic relations with Iran's longtime ally. A joint statement issued by Iran and Syria said Raisi and his host, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, emphasized cooperation in the reconstruction of Syria, which has endured 12 years of civil war. It also said Raisi invited Assad to visit Tehran. Both countries welcomed recent efforts by some Arab states to revive relations with Syria, a fellow Arab nation, after they shunned Assad for years due to his brutal actions in the civil war. Charles Lister is a Syria analyst at the Middle East Institute in Washington. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke to him on the phone May 5th and asked what impact Raisi's visit will have on the already close alliance between Iran and Syria.
I don't think it does necessarily anything to fundamentally transform the nature of the relationship. It is, as you say, and has always been very close. I think the fact that we saw, you know, over a dozen relatively substantive political, economic development deals, you know, signed during a presidential visit, the first in well over a decade. And specifically the fact that that visit happened, you know, just days after a series of fairly significant efforts by Arab states to re-engage with the Syrian regime and to try to sway it in certain directions. None of that was a coincidence. I don't think the Syrian-Iranian relationship has changed at all, but I think the timing and the optics of the visit and the fact that it did come with some substantive economic deals was both the Syrian and the Iranian way of sending a message back to the Arab states that it is us that have the advantage. It is us that have been victorious, and you are coming to grovel to our feet. And you don't get to determine our relationships, and you certainly don't get to determine, you know, our economic future. So I think it was a message, frankly, more than anything else. It's the kinds of economic deals and arrangements and memorandums of understanding that we've seen agreed over the years. But certainly we got a fairly good number of them all at once this time around.
Well, if that really is the message that Iran is trying to send with this visit of Raisi to Syria, how do you think Saudi Arabia and Jordan would respond? Because Saudi Arabia has already started a reconciliation process with Iran. Jordan seems to be considering a similar process. Wouldn't it kind of be like Iran spitting in their faces when they're reaching out their hands?
Well, to an extent, yes. I suppose spitting in your face is a little bit better than firing, you know, Houthi ballistic missiles across your border. So I think even if we're measuring in millimeters here, we're in a somewhat better place than we were in terms of the Saudi-Iranian relationship than we were, you know, 2 or 3 months ago. So we're measuring this in baby steps. You know, I think steps like this all come within a broader wave across the region, which is being described by regional states as de-escalation. Personally, I worry that there's not that much substance in a lot of these re-engagements and normalizations, Syria included, but is only one of them. And in that respect, it's not surprising to see that amidst all of that, quote unquote, de-escalation, the likes of Iran are still perfectly capable of sort of jabbing back and trying to remind everybody else that Iran sees itself as the victor here. And I think ultimately that may end up being a bit more problematic than it is at the moment when those sort of messages of victory continue to be rubbed in to the Gulf states in particular. And we might start to see some of these things become a little bit less de-escalatory and a little bit more problematic.
Why is it that you think, let's say, the Saudis, the Jordanians, other Gulf states might be reluctant to keep stretching the hand out to Iran when these are the messages that they get?
Well, I think we will have to be very frank here. Certainly, we'll never hear this from the Arab states, but they are coming into this process as the losers. You know, they didn't win in Yemen. They didn't win in Syria. They didn't win in Iraq. And in other places, you could add to the list. And so as a result, for now, in public, there is an optics of, you know, we are the mature statesmen of the region, and we're coming here to de-escalate, and we're coming here to resolve conflicts and crises. But they don't have the leverage necessary, frankly, to do that substantively, particularly in the Syrian case. But they are doing this because there is just this wave of steps being taken across the region to, quote unquote, to de-escalate. And if you are a leading statesman in the region or a leading player in the region, you don't want to be sort of left behind by that wave. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of bandwagoning at the moment. And honestly, when you speak to a lot of senior officials in the region, they're kind of giddy in excitement about how much de-escalation is happening. And I think that's kind of taken over too. It's like its own self-fulfilling energy. So I do think that at some point there will come this harder realization that, you know, they don't have the capacity to really push all of these initiatives forward. I think that's one of the reasons why we've heard Ayman Safadi, the Jordanian foreign minister, you know, in so many of his public comments and a recent interview on CNN, he made the point to say that, you know, we need the West, you know, support here. It's crucial that we've got America's support. I mean, he's saying that for a reason, because they're not going to achieve anything of what they want to achieve unless they get the United States and Europe on board. Incidentally, they're not going to. They might get some public votes of, you know, by all means, try this re-engagement out, but they're not going to get the full-throated support, let alone the involvement of the U.S. and Europe.
Well, at least publicly, the Biden administration has been welcoming of Saudi Arabia's overture to Iran, saying that it would see that as potentially, you know, improving regional stability. So why wouldn't the Biden administration want to get more deeply involved in that kind of process?
Well, I think in large part because behind the scenes, I think there's some skepticism in the Biden administration that until now, we haven't seen a lot of substance to support this de-escalated relationship between Iran and Saudi. So we've seen meetings, we've seen statements supportive of de-escalation, but neither the Saudis nor the Iranians have taken really significant substantive steps that will make long-lasting, sustainable changes to the otherwise de-escalatory dynamic between the two countries. And so at the moment, what we've seen is, as you point out, US statements of support, because you can't not support something that looks like de-escalation. So we're certainly not going to see criticism of it. But they're guarded statements of support. I mean, to an extent, I think the Biden administration was annoyed that the first steps of that de-escalation took place alongside China instead of the United States. So that puts the Biden administration on a back foot from the get-go. But we couldn't possibly be seen to criticize these steps either. But I think we're guarded about where they are. On Syria, it's much more complicated because we have, I think rightfully, the principled position that this is a Syrian regime that has committed the most unbelievable amounts of war crimes and crimes against humanity over the past 12 years. And simply re-engaging it isn't going to solve any of the reasons why those crimes happened in the first place. And so what we've seen from the US is statements of encouragement that it is good. You know, talking is certainly better than fighting. But every single statement we've seen from the US and from European governments has then said, but any settlement, any negotiation with the Syrian regime must be based on UN Security Council Resolution 2254, within which there are a number of significant conditions that, frankly speaking, the Arab Initiative with Syria isn't getting anywhere near to accomplishing. So, again, very guarded from the US and from Europe.
That's the Middle East Institute's Charles Lister speaking with VOA's Michael Lippin. Be sure to visit voanews.com and click on the Iran tab at the top of the page for additional updates on Iran throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Steve Miller. In nearly 6 months of unrest in Iran, the regime turned to wholesale jailing of dissenting voices and threats to media overseas. But some experts say that those tactics have lost their power to instill fear. VOA's Arash Arabasadi is up next.
6 months of civil unrest after a young woman's death in the custody of Iran's morality police. In September of last year, 22-year-old Mahsa Amini was arrested for what the Islamic Republic described as immodest attire. Tehran released a video claiming to show Amini collapse in custody and blamed the fall for triggering a fatal heart attack. Her family disputed that account in an interview with VOA. Almost immediately, nationwide anger became worldwide condemnation of Iran's harsh treatment of Amini and countless others like her. In response, Tehran began jailing journalists critical of the regime. Iranian journalist and media advocate Yeghaneh Razaian watched from Washington as the government turned up the heat.
In multiple cases, we had the Committee to Protect Journalists were in touch with lawyers who were representing these journalists and their families. And one morning we wake up and our source is gone because the lawyer himself was arrested and thrown in jail.
The Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, documented nearly 100 media arrests from the end of September when protests began to early January. Of those, half were women.
Based on our annual research in 2022, at the end of the year, not only Iran became the biggest jailer of journalists in the world, but it was also the biggest jailer of women or female journalists.
Those arrested are accused of charges from vague anti-state activity to espionage, a crime punishable by death. But it's not just inside Iran's borders, as Rezaian says Iran looks to silence its critics abroad, like VOA Persian host Mahsa Alinejad.
The Islamic Republic hired three criminals from Eastern Europe. They were clearly a part of a criminal syndicate. they were hired by the Islamic Republic to kill me on U.S. soil.
But that was just one attempt.
The Islamic Republic actually tried to kidnap me first. The FBI stopped the kidnapping plot and they charged four people. One of them, Niloufar Bahodiri, is right now in prison. She received 4 years prison sentence.
Alinejad says she isn't deterred by Iran's attempts to reach her in the U.S.
So I tell myself that this is what I have two options. Thinkers, to feel miserable every single day or to make my oppressors feel miserable. Nightmare. Honestly, I choose the second one and that made me so powerful. Because look, I'm only 45 kilos. You see that I'm not even carrying a weapon, but they're scared of me. They're scared of millions of Iranian women like me who say no to them.
Back in Washington, Rezaian says that although Iranians no longer fear the regime like they once did, the threats and following violence remain very real.
And I fear for them, but I'm glad that they are brave and they are not afraid of telling the truth. They are not afraid of covering their own country and its realities.
Iran's permanent mission to the UN did not respond to VOA's request for comment. But the Islamic Republic recently announced the pardoning of tens of thousands of Iranians arrested since protests began. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And finally, Ukrainian and Iranian women living in London are finding a common cause, joining in regular protests against Russian expansionism and the tyranny of the Iranian government. Marcus Harden narrates this report by Umberto Aguiar to round us out.
London is the scene of frequent protests. Recently, the city witnessed Ukrainian flags waving together with historical Iranian flags as demonstrators protested the war and the Iranian government. U.S. officials said Iran is Russia's top military backer in the war. Iranian protesters want Tehran to stop supporting Russia. Ukrainian women are organizing weekly protests in London. Anna is one of the founders of Women Fight for Ukraine. Fearing for her family's safety, she asked VOA to use her first name only.
We actually draw a big parallel between Russians and how they didn't stand against their government when their government chose to attack Ukraine brutally. We are together with Iranians who support freedom and democracy as opposed to Russian and Iranian alliance of terror.
Ksenia manufactures teddy bears, but is finding it difficult to continue her work after the war started. She also asked us to withhold her last name.
What I miss my country the most,
Yes.
In Ukraine, I miss the most. No.
Unlike the soldiers back home, the demonstrators here don't carry guns. They don't wear uniforms. They fight on a different front, and their weapons are their fundraising, their voices, and their protests. Solomia Louise Havrilova fled her home and is now working in a London hospital. In Ukraine, she was a music teacher and an opera singer. Her father, Sergei Havrilov, was also an opera singer until he volunteered to join the Ukrainian army. Now, Havrilov sings opera while digging a trench with other Ukrainian soldiers.
As my father fighting in military now, I realized that I can fight here for my freedom, for my country, because here we can go to the protest. I can sing, and by singing, by donating, by doing the protest, we all can fight in some way for our freedom, for our country.
Ukraine, despite the full-scale invasion by Russia, has not perished, and neither has its desire to keep its freedom. The people of Ukraine and Iran here in London hold hands as they push for a better future at home. For Umberto Aguiar in London, Marcus Harden, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us this week. On behalf of the entire production team at Flashpoint Iran, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to follow the Voice of America on your favorite social media platforms for continuous updates. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Have a great day.